This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, it is Friday, December 20th, and we're live. Thanks for joining us, if you are in fact joining us live, or thanks for listening later. I appreciate it. You know, I get so many great questions from all of you out there. If you have a question or want some advice on something, you can call me 24/7 whenever you want at 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. So I like to just like load all my questions up in episode. And when we booked this guest, I thought, oh, this is going to be perfect because she's an actual doctor. So, you know, I can only give you advice as playing a doctor, but we've got like some actual trained person here. So you're going to get advice from both of us tonight. Let me tell you about my guest. Dr. Nazanin Moali is a licensed clinical psychologist and sex therapist in Los Angeles, California. Her private practice is located in the South Bay area, and she specializes in working with couples and individuals struggling with issues of sex and intimacy. Dr. Moali hosts a weekly podcast, which you should definitely check out, called Sexology, introducing the most intriguing findings in the psychology of sex and intimacy. Welcome to Sex Out Loud.
Thank you so much for having me. I love your show, and it's definitely a treat to be on this show.
So how did you get into this field? You know, there's so many folks who become clinical psychotherapists, but it's actually just a small number who decide to specialize in sex stuff.
Well, it's an interesting story. So I'm 38 and I'm telling people I've been doing sex education for 30 years. So what happens is like I was born in Iran right after Islamic Revolution. And my mom, she was a writer and an editor of magazine. Because of all of the changes in political environment, her family fled overnight and she kind of had developed this like very severe depression. And what happened is, again, she's a writer and she's a feminist. So I had this unlimited access to her French erotica and adult movies and books and all the sex education. And I started talking about it and doing sex education since I was 8. Perhaps not all accurate, but early on I learned that, okay, it's really easy for me to talk about sex. And as far as my clinical practice, what happens is I initially was working with people who were struggling with eating disorders and addiction. And I saw lots of commonality between people who are struggling with sex, food, and drugs. And it's just, I realized that many of our challenges comes with this complicated relationship that we have with pleasure. And what I learned that many of my clients who were coming in for those issues, they also needed to talk about sex and they didn't have enough sex education. And the more I started working with them, I got more interested in this field. I said, okay, I need to get further training in it. Because as you mentioned, as a psychologist, you don't necessarily, even as a psychologist, get training in sex education and doing sex therapy. So that's why I was so interested and I got more additional training in it. And now it's half of my practice is doing sex therapy, and the other half is helping people with eating disorders and addictions. And I see lots of kind of like overlapping struggles. So I love what I do, and that's how I got into it.
Okay, so as a child, besides getting access to your mom's French pornography, which is an amazing story, by the way, did you have open conversations about it? Like, did you actually talk about sex within your family?
It's a very interesting story because my mom was very open-minded. Because of, again, indicated by all of her material. But what happened is post-revolution in Iran, the environment was very oppressive. And she never gave me any kind of sex education. We never talked about it. And now when, as an adult, I'm having this conversation with her, she was telling me, I didn't know what to tell you because I didn't want you to get in trouble. And it's just that was interesting because I think not having information, as you know, can get you in trouble, but having information that could be very helpful. Again, I'm very grateful that I had access to all the readings and movies and books. Again, not age appropriate, and definitely we don't want our children to have access to those things. But I feel it helped me to become more comfortable with the concept of sex and pleasure.
But then I'm seeing you running around Iran as an 8-year-old, being like the go-to person on the playground with your friends. and did you think that like you would get in trouble? Because it seems to me this is a kind of a radical act for a very young girl.
It's interesting because I learned to, I'm very good with adapting my language to the person that I'm talking to. And I had that skill from the beginning. So if people were more conservative, then the messages that I was giving them were more conservative. And that's what I do now in my practice. I have very conservative people, couples who are struggling with sexuality, and very open-minded people. Again, I can see as a kid, perhaps there was a possibility of me getting in trouble. But I never had any issue with that. But yes, that can be a very risky situation.
Well, I also was wondering in terms of who comes to you, because I think there are some cultural differences here that sometimes folks can't necessarily grapple with if they don't understand. Like, we all grow up with negative messages around sexuality, but depending where you grew up, those messages can be different and can affect people in different ways.
Absolutely. And I think the other piece of it that like we all can give the same message, but if the message I'm giving might be more well received or the message that you're giving more well received depending on the audience. So I find that perhaps people who are from the conservative background, they're more comfortable coming to a female quote-unquote doctor talking about sex. And if I'm giving them, and that's been very rewarding to helping people to kind of open their horizon and kind of think outside the box. But yes, so it gave me, my background gives me opportunity right now to work with a diverse population.
I think that's really important because I also think that although there are these through lines for people around things like shame or just lack of knowledge and education about how desire and pleasure works, how arousal works, how their own bodies in some cases work, it does show up in different ways for different people. Wouldn't you say that?
Absolutely. And I think that's why I'm so grateful that we have different sex educators, sex therapists, and psychologists in the field because of our background, we have the different ability to connect and convey the message to people from various kind of like background and upbringings.
Okay, well, we are at our first commercial break. Or that's what A-Rod tells me, and I'm supposed to listen to him. Let's take a break and hear from our fantastic sponsors, including the Pleasure Chest. People, today is like the last day, and I mean the last few hours, for you to get free 2-day shipping to get your gifts in time for Christmas. So go to pleasurechest.com. If you don't make it on this deadline, you can still take advantage of a number of specials and great deals they have on their site and in their stores. So let's take a break. And when we come back, more with Dr. Moali.
Hey everyone, it's the holiday season and there is so much going on at the Pleasure Chest. You should probably get a pen and take notes. First, their holiday kits are now in stock and they start at just $25. They come in beautifully wrapped gift boxes. And pleasure checks are back. Spend $100 and receive a pleasure check gift voucher for $15. Spend $150 and receive a check for $25. This is available in-store only through December 31st, and they're redeemable during any future store visit through March 31st, 2020. Fine print cannot be combined with any other offers or discounts. It's also time for 12 days of giveaways. The Pleasure Chest is ready to stock your stuffings with the latest and greatest new toys and a few classics. From December 14th to the 26th, check Pleasure Chest's social media and you may have a chance to win. Follow them on Instagram at Pleasure Chest Stores. Plus, there's 10% off all orders over $200 through January 1st, online only. And finally, free shipping from the 10th to the 19th, which is the last day to order if you want to get it by Christmas. Go to pleasurechest.com and take advantage of these amazing specials. You may know me for creating various forms of media centered around sexuality, gender, relationships, feminism, and pop culture. I'm ready to take a big risk and do something completely different, and I hope you might join me. I'm working on a family memoir focused on my own coming-of-age story woven in with my father's. It's a story about growing up, multi-generational queer experience and history, love, loss, and the meaning of home. I started it and I hope to have it completed by the end of 2019. This isn't just a new book, though. It is way outside my comfort zone, and I've been wanting to write it for years. But I've been kind of terrified to share this personal story with the public. I mean, I'm comfortable telling you about my love of butt plugs, but it feels way scarier to tell you about my family, my innermost thoughts, my mental health, and one of the most significant events in my life, the death of my father. If you want to support me and my writing, you can go to patreon.com/TristanTaramino. Thanks.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com. You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. My guest tonight is Dr. Nazanin Moali, who's a licensed clinical psychologist and also a sex therapist in Los Angeles. I want to get to some listener questions. And so we've got a bunch from the voicemail. We also have some that you emailed me. But let us start with this question, which is about bisexuality.
Hello. I love the show. And I have a question about bisexuality. So I have this experience of bisexuality where it feels like sometimes I'm totally attracted to one kind of person and other times I'm totally attracted to a different kind of person. And when it switches, it's almost like the other one never existed sometimes. It's a total trip. And I've never really heard this talked about by people. You know, it's stuff like bisexuality. You're attracted to everyone. Hooray. So I'm wondering if anyone can talk more about the sort of cyclical bisexuality, or like, I don't even know what to call it, but just the sort of changing nature of that. So thanks for the show. And have a good day.
This is a great question. And the caller's sort of right that, like, I haven't ever heard someone describe their bisexuality like in this way. What do you think?
I think that's very interesting. I certainly had clients in my practice get that throughout the years that we worked together. I've seen them in the relationship with the same sex or opposite sex. And one of my clients that I loved her, and she was describing a situational lesbian. And I don't know if it's a kind of politically correct thing, but that's how she was describing herself. And I think throughout my work with clients, I learned that, first of all, as you know, there is a galaxy of orientation, and we all have some component of same-sex attraction and some component of opposite-sex attraction. And depending on where we are in this galaxy, it might be different at different times. But I certainly had clients that had told me that it's important for them they fall in love and get attracted to the person, whether they're male or same sex or kind of opposite sex. So I've certainly seen it in my practice. And I had experience with it. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And I feel sometimes you get stuck on putting a label on things and be getting really invested on that instead of getting curious about what is it that I'm attracted to this person, or what kind of what is it about my erotic blueprint that's kind of like matching here?
Yeah, I mean, in one way I identify, because I think we all go through sort of phases, and there are times when I feel like I'm really interested in masculinity or men or masculine people. And then it will sort of change and morph. And I may be more like attracted and sort of like hooked into femininity, femmes, women. But it is interesting that, like, I feel like some part of this question is, am I doing bisexuality wrong? You know what I mean? Like, there's some other message in here, which is like, please tell me you've heard of this, because, you know, which is at the heart of a lot of these questions, right? Because I don't know if this is normal or what it means.
Absolutely. And I think related to that, I feel with bisexuality, and I'm sure you talked about it many times, that there is this kind of confusion and lots of misconceptions around it. That they feel like perhaps, at least we hear that men who are bisexual, then maybe they're closeted gay, or women who are attracted to kind of they're bisexual, they're just doing it for men or for the partner. And that is so not true. So you're right that at heart of it, we get worried about if I'm doing it right, if I'm normal, if other people are experiencing this. So I think you're definitely pointing out to the really important thing here.
Okay, now we've got a letter from Jim, and Jim writes to me about condoms. He says, Trojan magnums are indicated on the packaging as large-sized condoms. If a fully erect man puts on a Trojan magnum condom and it fits securely before penetration and during penetration, i.e. it doesn't slip, does that mean that the man's penis is in fact large? Have you asked women the age-old question, does size matter, and gathered any useful data? Okay, before I give you an opportunity, I just need to go on a rant here. I don't myself have a penis, but I just don't understand men's obsession with penis size. Like, I do. I mean, the patriarchy and like our culture is phallocentric, and, you know, the penis is sort of at the center of all desire and pleasure for everyone, regardless of sexual orientation or what you really like. But I feel like we're still on this. We're still asking this question. My answer always and forever will be no. It's really not about that. I mean, it's just, I know there's some people who can be specific and some people who may fetishize a big penis or fetishize redheads or really like them, but I'm looking for a person who has all these qualities that vibe with me, who I can make do with all equipment, any bodies. I can work it. I've got the experience, and I don't know why we're still asking and answering this question.
I agree with you. And I think the other piece of it is that because as you can imagine, this question comes up a lot. And what I heard from many of my female clients who are identifying as heterosexual, I know this is heteronormative, they're talking about it's a matter of goodness of fit. Mm-hmm. And also what other things are going on in the bedroom that makes things exciting and great. So it's definitely not about the size. Even in many of my clients, I talk about, like, when they tell me that when the partner is big, their penis is big, it's uncomfortable, they don't want to have sex, they're just limiting the position. So as you said, it's not necessarily correlated to having a great sex. I know it's cliche, but I tell people, like your biggest sex organ is your brain.
Your brain.
And your eroticism and your ability to kind of like play into this kind of erotic charged situation with your partner. So I know that there are lots of, in the society, especially men to men, are this kind of concept of the size is really important. But as you said, I think at heart of it is no matter what you got, if you know how to use it and you have good communication with your partner, that's great. And you're enough.
Yeah, because I don't want to shame you, Jim, for asking the question. That was not my intention. So I'm going to dial that back a little bit. But I do want to say that I feel like there's so much emphasis placed on the dick, and you're a whole person. Like, what actually matters is your whole personhood and your whole self. And I don't want us to constantly equate all sex with penises and then have to sort of evaluate. Because I feel like there's insecurity is a piece of this, right? Asking, is my penis large? Is it large enough? Is also just about people's insecurity. And I feel like part of what's happened is because the education that we do have is so heteronormative, it's put too much emphasis on these are your genitals and they're like our good genitals and bad genitals, rather than how do we experience pleasure? How do we make each other feel good? How do we communicate to make those things happen? You're like, you're more than your dick, Jim. That's what I want to say. Okay. Okay, this next question is about open relationships. It comes from someone anonymous. I definitely want to have control over designing my relationship style and creating one that works for me. I don't want to control other people, cling to them, or be possessive of them. To be honest, I never dreamed or fantasized about the one, a soulmate, or the perfect person for me. I don't want to go with the flow of relationships, and I don't want society to dictate what I should be doing. In a way, I want to deviate from social norms and embrace free love, where I'll have the freedom at any time to explore other people, other relationships, and sexual experiences. But how do I find people or communities that share similar values like these? Love relationships seem like a big, big world out there. That's a good one. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, the kudos to the listener that she or he knows what she wants or he wants and they want, and kind of thinking about how can I engineer that to get it. And sometimes in the society, there is this kind of hierarchy of monogamy is better than non-monogamy and kind of all this bullshit that comes with it. But definitely there are many people out there that they are interested in what you're interested in. If it's an open relationship, there are communities that you can go depending on. I guess the first step would be kind of thinking about what kind of a structure you think might be a good fit for you. Are you thinking about polyamory? Are you thinking about swinging? What is it that you want, or what is it that you want to experiment? So there are conventions that you can go and kind of meet similar-minded people. There are bars and clubs and play parties in LA. I know that you can go. So it depends on what kind of a thing you're interested in. And you don't need to know necessarily right now, but it's important to kind of think about what are some of the things that I'm willing to experiment with. And even with new partners, you get surprised that if you are meeting people on kind of bars and other places and dating sites, that there are many people that are open to examining the open relationship. I think what's important for you to kind of develop the good communication skills to kind of asking for what you want and kind of like defining what kind of an open relationship you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, at this day and age, like there are small cities and large cities, and nearly all of them have social groups, organizations, like you said, events, weekends, and sometimes clubs and parties where you can meet like-minded people. You know, like I always say, go to a workshop on non-monogamy, even if it's a 101, like go to that workshop and you're going to meet a lot of non-monogamous people who are interested in what you're interested in. And I think also the dating app sites are getting better about people being able to identify as non-monogamous or identify what kind of relationship styles outside of monogamy that they're interested in. So I do think that, you know, if this was a decade ago, it would be hard to navigate stuff online. But I feel like the dating sites, I mean, not obviously like eHarmony, but a bunch of the other dating sites have gotten good about, you know, making space for non-monogamous people. And so I would say kind of hit it from both ends, both the in real life meeting people and also trying some online dating. And I feel like that's a place where you can like clearly put it out there. Hey, I'm looking for a non-monogamous relationship. And then you're just going to weed people out automatically who aren't into that. Okay, so we're going to take another commercial break. When we come up, come back, we've got some great questions about BDSM and kink, two that are sort of related but also different. So stay with us. More listener questions when we get back. Hey everyone, it's Tristan, and it's time to listen up because we're going to talk about one of my very favorite subjects, porn. We all know that it's not hard to find porn on the internet, but finding porn that you like, that's a different story. Sometimes you can spend more time looking for a scene that you like than you actually spend watching it. And it can feel like a never-ending black hole of cliches, bad scripts, and plastic leather sofas. If you want to try something new with relatable storylines, realistic situations of very hot sex, and cinematic quality, then you need to check out the new LustCinema.com. Founded by Erica Lust, Lust Cinema is her new U.S. porn studio for lovers of cinema and sex. On Lust Cinema, you'll find original series and feature films shot by Erica herself and other U.S.-based female directors, as well as a huge catalog of content from other adult filmmakers. If you already know Erica Lust, then you know that she makes beautiful cinematic porn on X Confessions. So expect nothing less on her new Lust Cinema. You'll experience the whole feeling of sex, the passion and the pleasure. And on Lust Cinema, everyone's pleasure is equally important. Hear, hear to that. Erica wants Sex Out Loud listeners to experience her world of lust, so she's giving you a one-month membership for just $5. Visit www.lustcinema.com/Tristan to get your $5 month and start streaming now. That's lustcinema.com/Tristan. Lust Cinema. Great porn, better sex.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I'm going to give you the phone number again. You can always ask your questions about sex and relationships. You can give me comments about the show. You can always call 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. I'm back talking to licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Mouali, and we are answering your questions. Okay. This is a good one that comes from someone with the initials SM, which is funny, given that it's a kinky question. Dear Tristan, my husband and I were monogamous for 14 years and opened our marriage 7 months ago. We don't have any veto power. We just try to have consideration for each other. Dating has gone surprisingly well, although neither has found established partners. I recently did a scene with a play partner. I told my husband my goals beforehand and that I may become marked, as that was my goal. I had an amazing time. When I got home, I told my husband I was marked with bruises. He became upset, saying, "Well, you know, you don't let me do that to you, so why would you let this other guy?" a bit of background. My husband is a top as far as impact, spanking mostly, but not dominant. Before opening our marriage, we tried to get to a place where he could dominate me in the way I liked, and either he couldn't or he wouldn't, which I decided was fine. That was a main reason for me seeing other people, to fulfill this part of myself. I can go further and more intensely with the power exchange, so I don't go as far with my husband, and that's hard to explain to him. I have no intention of stopping this side of myself, but I want to be sensitive to his feelings. I kept the bruises away from him and didn't involve him in any of my aftercare as I was, you know, processing this scene. I just snuggled myself while trying to be sensitive to his feelings, which was hard. When I tried to explain this to my husband, he took it as me criticizing his abilities by needing this other person, rather than us just not matching up in that way. I love him more for accepting my needs outside of him, and I want him to know that without him feeling bad. I love him and I love us, but I also need this other thing. This is a good one.
This is very interesting. Should I start or you're going to start?
Yeah, go ahead.
So first of all, it's amazing that they had this openness and kind of understanding that after 14 years, they were able to have this kind of like change in their relationship dynamics. Again, this is a new data. So one thing that I really, really recommend people to do when they open up their relationship is to talk about their fidelity agreement, what's okay and what's not okay. What are some of the things they can do with it? Partner and they don't, and negotiate it because of this. But again, at times, even when you are negotiating things on what's okay and what's not okay, as the relationships progress and as things progress, the partner might kind of realize that there are things that they don't like. So I definitely encourage her to kind of have this conversation with, revisit this with her partner, with her husband, another time when things are not as charged, and kind of talking about, kind of having the kind of open-ended question, kind of thinking about ahead of time, what are some of the things that are non-negotiable for her in the sexual relationship outside the marriage that she has, and what are some of the things that are negotiable for her, and kind of like start with this open-ended question with the partner, with the husband, that what is it about this that makes you uncomfortable, and kind of like let him talk about it, and then use kind of reflective listening that we use with other people, because sometimes our partners get reactive because they feel they're not being heard. So you can kind of tell your partner, kind of, okay, honey, I hear you saying this, and kind of reflecting back to the partner. And then if you feel kind of after that, you make sure that he knows that you heard her, then you can talk about why is this something for you that's non-negotiable, and kind of like talking about, start kind of building a structure around this, that what are some of the, what can you do to make it more comfortable for him if that's important for you, or kind of creating what he wants more of in the relationship with you in this kind of like sex life that you guys have, that make it more, is it about him feeling insecure that you're willing to go there with a partner? Is there anything that you guys can do in the marriage to make him more secure? And it doesn't necessarily, even if you feel insecure, it's not necessarily about that act. It talks about this unmet need somewhere else. And I think it's important to kind of address that need instead of kind of trying to you perhaps suppressing part of your sexuality that's, it seems like it's important for you, or kind of hiding it from your partner. But I think the first step is, I know when things are hard with our partner, we just don't want to avoid it. But I think it's super important to have an open discussion about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot going on here, but I think there's a fundamental truth that lots of people struggle with, which is that they take someone's desire to have experiences with someone else as a personal slight or affront, right? That if she wants to be dominated in a certain way, and she wants marks, and he's like, not, that's not his style of dominance, right? She said he can top me, but he can't dominate me. Well, that seems, you know, pretty straightforward, right? But he is interpreting it as, I'm not good enough, right? How could you let this other person do this to you, but not me? Why is this person dominating you in the way you want, and I can't? So I think part of the work for him is to not make it about a sort of comparison, not make it about his sort of shortcomings or the thing he can't do for her. I say, let's focus on the great things about this relationship and what they both love and like about each other. And he has to come to the realization that if she wants to do this thing with other people, it's not a comment on him.
Absolutely. Hi, yes.
Okay. There's a kind of a related but different question also about dominance. This is from a caller. So let's take a listen.
Hi, Tristan. I am a cis bi poly female, and I have a cis het male poly male nesting partner. I am not submissive in general, but I do need a more dominant partner in the bedroom. When we first met, my partner said he was vanilla, but some exploration showed he is actually on the dominant side. I've been kinky for years. I'm a switch. I have a very, very, very difficult time submitting to someone and require a very strong, trusting relationship with him. We've had a few wonderful power exchange romps, but he is such an amazing feminist and so worried he will hurt me that even a slight grimace from me will cause him to release everything and ask if I'm okay. I usually say, I didn't say the safe word, but then the mood is broken and he becomes overly concerned that he hurt or upset me. He says his former partners all got mad if he showed any dominance or even initiated sex. He has a very violent hobby and he also has a propensity to break things, kind of like a puppy who doesn't know his own strength. And this, along with his very liberal feminist mindset, seems to inhibit him from truly tapping into his dominant, aggressive side in the bedroom. I just want him to throw me around, smack me around. He tried smacking me once, and he actually cried, unable to get past his don't hit people if they're not wearing armor mindset. We've talked this over and over. We have all your books. We've taken classes. No matter what we do, though, I just can't seem to get it through his incredible feminist brain that sometimes it's okay to rough me up. Do you have any suggestions for resources? Thanks, Tristan.
Oh, I love this question. Because it's actually more common than you think, listener. That's the first thing I want to say, is that I get this a lot. I talk to a lot of cis men who have fears about tapping into their dominant side and what that means about them, what, you know, if it makes them a bad person, if it makes them a bad feminist, if it means they want to brutalize or objectify or dominate women in real life versus in the bedroom. And so first, I just want to say you're not alone. And I think it's a common problem. And I think also, right now, there's been a lot of soul searching among men and masculine people about their treatment, mostly of women. And so we're in a moment right now where consent has been centered and where, quite frankly, men have been put on notice for their bad fucking behavior. So you could see how this could scare someone who, you know, you're asking your husband like, oh, please behave badly. And he's saying, no. Everything I talk about during the day and everything I read says I'm not supposed to do that. Now you want me to do that. I don't know what to do. I think consent has to be at the center of this. I think you have to explain to him. Well, I thought it was very powerful what you said, that you really, really need to have a trusting relationship in order to even just ask for this desire. And so you have now established that with him, which is a gift, right? It's really good. You feel okay enough. You feel like you trust him enough to say, I want to be dominated and I want you to really go for it. So I think he needs to realize that, like, you're asking for this. This turns you on. This is what you want. And in many ways, he can do this as a service to you, right? If he feels like, I don't know if I can do this. Well, this is what I'm asking for. And if you know what I mean? If you want to make me happy, which sounds like he wants to make you happy, then he can sort of step up. But then the part two of this is some internal work for him, which is something about his dominance scares him. Something about his dominance makes him uncomfortable. That's some internal work for him to do to figure out, why does this terrify me? What am I afraid of? Can I work through these issues and get to the other side? What do you think?
Well, I love that all the suggestion that you gave, similar to you, I hear it all the time that people are so scared that their sexual desire and fantasies are not politically correct. And they're oftentimes are not. And as far as the resources, one of my all-time, your books are fantastic, and one of the other all-time favorite that I have is Arousal by Michael Bader, that he talks about the nature of our sexual fantasies and how some of these wild fantasies that we have psychologically, their purpose is to give us psychological safety. So he can check it out, and perhaps they can, and you can check it out, our listener, the female one that contacted us, and kind of learn more about kind of psychological component of these desires. And similar to you, that I have a female client that they love being dominated, but they are feminist people outside the bedroom, and inside the bedroom, they just love that. And I think that's good that they've been taking workshops and doing all this work. But I think it's important to keep in mind that we all have a shadow side.
I'm so glad you went there. Yes, go there.
And I think it's important to honor that. I think when things get crazy is when we are kind of denying and suppressing that part of ourselves. And I can almost guarantee that the more you're acting on, and he's acting on that part of him and leaning into that part of him, that masculine dominant side, it's actually less likely for him to act it out outside the bedroom, because it helped him to integrate perhaps that shadow side of him into this kind of like his own psyche. But I think as far as how to go about it, I think one, I think if you guys are try different things and if didn't kind of work out, I think maybe adding on one kinky thing at time. Kind of thinking about, we're going to have the great sex that we had. Honey, I really want to go, you go for spanking or smacking and all of this. Just let's do this time. And you're kind of like his sandwiching it in between all the other things that you guys are doing. That's great. So that way, then you can afterward give him lots of positive reinforcement so he can see that, okay, that happened and nothing bad happened out of it. So it's just like helping him to practice that muscle. And I think one other thing that Tristan, you mentioned that was fabulous and fantastic about him being scared of his dominant side. And I would be kind of curious what kind of a role model he had that kind of scared him from that. At times, people had abusive people in their back, some kind of father figures, step parents, someone that kind of they showed their aggressive side in a way that kind of left a bad taste in the partner's mouth, and they just don't want to turn to that. But kind of reassuring that we're just playing this in the bedroom and it's not impacting our relationship outside the bedroom can be helpful, and kind of helping your partner, her partner, to leaning into this new role.
I agree with you about the role models, right? We've got a lot of role models for toxic masculinity. They're just running around and running the government as well. And so we don't necessarily have a kind of strong, feminist, thoughtful, compassionate, dominant man out there to say, oh, can you be more like blank? So that's another interesting piece to kind of unpack. Okay, we're running over time. A-Rod is just bugging me. So we're going to go to another commercial break, and we will come back and talk about, well, a number of things. One is chronic illness and pleasure, and then we're going to hear some listener feedback. So stay with us.
Hey everyone, it's the holiday season and there is so much going on at the Pleasure Chest, you should probably get a pen and take notes. First, their holiday kits are now in stock and they start at just $25. They come in beautifully wrapped gift boxes. And pleasure checks are back. Spend $100 and receive a pleasure check gift voucher for $15. Spend $150 and receive a check for $25. This is available in-store only through December 31st, and they're redeemable during any future store visit through March 31st, 2020. Fine print cannot be combined with any other offers or discounts. It's also time for 12 days of giveaways. The Pleasure Chest is ready to stock your stuffings with the latest and greatest new toys and a few classics. From December 14th to the 26th, check Pleasure Chest's social media and you may have a chance to win. Follow them on Instagram at Pleasure Chest Stores. Plus, there's 10% off all orders over $200 through January 1st, online only. And finally, free shipping from the 10th to the 19th, which is the last day to order if you want to get it by Christmas. Go to pleasurechest.com and take advantage of these amazing specials.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at PuckerUp.com. That's Tristan at PuckerUp.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking with Dr. Nazanin Moali, a clinical psychologist with a practice in the Los Angeles area, and we're answering your questions. So someone wrote in named Fred and asks, what information do you have on living with a partner who has fibromyalgia? How do we navigate her chronic illness, and how do we get sexually passionate when her fibromyalgia is not triggered? This is, I think, a question becoming more and more common as people deal with more chronic illness.
Would you like me to start, or you're going to start?
You can start.
Excellent. So you're right that unfortunately chronic illnesses, chronic pains are these day and age are very common. I love that Fred is thinking about keeping the sexuality alive in the relationship. Because sometimes when our partners are struggling with chronic illness or ourselves were struggling, we don't think that sexuality is important. It becomes kind of an afterthought. So it's really important to think about it and work through it and plan accordingly. First of all, I think the most important thing is kind of thinking about having this open conversation with the partner that what are some of the times that they're not necessarily feel tired, exhausted, in pain, and what is it, the morning, afternoons, evening? So kind of having some more understanding of what are some of the times that could be optimal for the partners to get engaged in kind of the sexual play, and kind of like talking to them about kind of what can you do like the, for the partner that's struggling, what can she do to reduce her vulnerability? Is there things that makes it more comfortable for her at when like pre-sex that can make her more kind of more in the mood? Is it that thing that needs to be addressed, medication that needs to be taken? And also the other piece of it is kind of thinking about if they've been together before, our sexuality, regardless whether our partner is struggling with chronic illness or not, is always evolving and changing. So with this condition, what are some of the things that are pleasurable for the partner? Perhaps this is a new territory and you, Fred, and your partner can examine what are some of the touches that she might or he might, I think she is finding pleasurable. And you guys can experiment with that and kind of talking about kind of having more open communication about things that are pleasurable, and also kind of understanding that there are going to be seasons that if her fibromyalgia is not as present, that then sexuality, sex can be more frequent. And there are seasons that if the symptoms are more, and maybe that become a less of a priority. But I think pacing is really important for her partner and for him to know, kind of have this, develop this understanding of when is the optimal time to have sex, what can he and she do to make sure she's less vulnerable to feeling the pain, and kind of being playful and exploring what are some of the new changes and adjustments they need to make to continue having fulfilling, wonderful sex lives.
I love that. I love that answer. And I would just add that as someone myself who deals with chronic pain, is that I like to think of it as like not just a hot or cold situation, which is I'm in pain, cold, or now I'm ready, hot, but more like how can you keep things warm? And then when your body allows you, go to hot. So the warm part is like, what are other things that make me feel close to you or that my body can do or that I experience pleasure, whether it's like drawing someone a bath or, you know, or cuddling with them and just stroking them really gently or getting them their heating pad. What are some things that you can do to continue to like make the connection happen, but that aren't necessarily sexual in a way that your body's just like not capable of basically at that point, so that it's not a like turn off the switch or turn the switch on, that actually if you can keep the warmth and the connection going, it's easier to get to hot if you're warm than when you're cold. That's where I'm at. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. This was so, so helpful. And I just really appreciate it. And I want to tell people how to get you. You should listen to her podcast. Her podcast is at sexologypodcast.com. And you can find out more about the private practice at oasis2care. And it's the number two, oasis2care.com. She is on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Oasis2Care. Again, the number two. Thanks so much, Dr. Mualli. I really, really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. And thank you for all the great work that you're doing to increasing our sexual awareness and putting out this wonderful show on a weekly basis.
Several weeks ago, I asked you, my listeners, to tell me what justice would look like for a survivor of sexual assault. And I think this was on the show, the 350th show that we did with Nicoletta Heidegger. And I had a bunch of calls and a bunch of feedback. And to close the show, I want to share this one in particular.
Hi, actually, I heard about this from Tristan on Sluts and Scholars. She was asking to hear people who've been survivors of sexual assault, you know, what happened, how did they feel, blah, blah, blah. And so I just kind of wanted to give my short story. I was in a relationship for almost 4 years in high school. He was my high school boyfriend. And I didn't realize it was abuse till about 2 years after we broke up. I started having anxiety and panic attacks and whenever unconsensual sex was brought up. And with him, it was pretty much he had me believe that he was sick and then guilted me into sex for him to feel better. I was required to send him at least 10 naked pictures a day. If I didn't, he would get upset and emotionally abuse me. He would constantly use suicide threats. It was just relentless, and it got to the point where after I broke up with him shortly after we graduated high school, and we were still having sex because he was still guilt tripping me and abusing me in other ways. And eventually he was threatening to kill himself, and I snapped and got to the last point where I called his college where he was going. I told him that he was suicidal, that what he was doing. I texted his family. I was like, I can't handle this anymore. I'm sorry, but I need to grow. And from then we didn't talk, and we had one talk, and I still haven't really confronted him about this because I didn't realize it was abuse till what, years later. And at this point, after going to years of therapy, I've been to a sexual assault therapy that was thankfully provided by my city. And honestly, for like what I would want, as much as I want him dead and I would love to hit him with a car, I can't, obviously. I think I would want an apology, and I would want him on a list. So just to make sure that like people knew what he did, and for him to like attend a class of like, hey, this is consent. This is, you know, no means no, and you can't pressure people just because this is what you want. And out of my own selfish gain, I would want him to like monetarily pay for my therapy, because I didn't start getting anxiety and depression till after I realized what happened. And yeah, I think I would want him to pay for all that, but I think that's pretty much it. So I hope you appreciate my rambling somewhat, and thank you so much for what you're doing with your podcast and being so vocal out there. Thank you. Bye.
Well, I want to thank you, listener, first of all, for sharing that, which was really personal, really vulnerable, and really real. You expressed a lot of different emotions in that one story, and I feel like a lot of people and other survivors can probably relate to that. It's a complex process, and as you know, it took you a long, long time to get through it. And so I just appreciate your honesty, because I think we all need to have the opportunity to be, you know, both angry and compassionate and have wants and needs about our own justice process. So thank you, caller. I really appreciate that. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, senior producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, A-Rod, my engineer. A-Rod's going away, people. What are we going to do? Oh, right. We have a new one. His name is Andrew. And everyone at Voice America, tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern for another edition of the show. My guest next week is going to be Dixie De La Tour, who is the creator and host of Body Storytelling. So we're going to hear some dirty stories next week, which should be fun for the holidays. Until then, you can catch me on social media. I'm at Tristan Taramino across all platforms, and take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.